Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. This presidential election week has been long, and it's frayed an awful lot of nerves. And that's why we thought on our show today it was time for something warm and soothing, something that reaffirms the basic American values that we all treasure. That's why we're going to revisit our conversation last spring with best-selling author Lee Smith. She's about as down-to-earth as anyone we've ever talked to on this show. Smith joined us to talk about her memoir, Dime Store, which is filled with stories about growing up and eventually leaving her beloved Appalachian mountain town of Grundy, Virginia. Smith burst onto the literary scene with her novel, Fair and Tender Ladies. She's been writing novels and stories set in the South for more than 45 years. Lee Smith, I'm so happy to have you here for Two-Way Street. I think an interesting starting point is there's an essay in here called Marble Cake and Moonshine.
Yes.
Are you open to reading the beginning of that?
Absolutely. This is actually one of my favorite essays because I think it's always important for a young writer to find her voice. And so often you find it in places where you didn't really expect. So want me to start from the beginning?
Sure.
Although I don't usually write autobiographical fiction, the main character in one of my short stories sounds suspiciously like the girl I used to be. Quote, "More than anything else in the world, I wanted to be a writer. I didn't want to bother to learn to write, of course. I just wanted to be a writer. And I often pictured myself poised at the foggy edge of a cliff someplace in the south of France, wearing a cape, drawing furiously on a long cigarette, hollow-cheeked and haunted. I had been romantically dedicated to the grand idea of being a writer ever since I could remember."
I think that's such a wonderful starting point for a conversation with you because it really does capture who you are. You started writing when you were a very little girl.
Absolutely. By the time I got to college, which was Hollins College, now Hollins University in Roanoke, I was this person who was still very romantically involved with the idea of, quote, being a writer, as you can tell from that package.
So you say in the book that Grundy, which is kind of isolated because of rugged mountains.
Yes, and before highways, before any four-lane highways or anything, it was even more isolated.
You say the mountains around it were so steep, the sun didn't come up till 11 o'clock. And another point you say, so steep that a cow fell off and went straight through the roof and landed in Aunt Bess and Uncle Clydesdale's kitchen in downtown Grand. Uncle Clyde's kitchen.
That's true. Absolutely true. And my mother, who had moved there from Eastern Virginia, she just used to weep because she would say she just couldn't raise the kind of roses she knew she could grow anywhere else because the sun didn't really hit our yard till 11 and it was gone.
What happened with this cow?
Oh, well, it just fell into the kitchen and into the soup beans, as I was always told in the summer. My family were all great storytellers in anything that ever happened, you heard it for the rest of your life.
You have a very funny observation. At one point, you say how stunning it was to you and your family the first time you saw a jogger come by the house.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was in the 60s. And I was sitting on the porch with my mother and my aunts, and we were all stringing beans. And all of a sudden, this boy came just running down the road, Route 460, in front of our house, just running to beat the band. And apparently, not going anywhere in particular, just running. And we stood up, you know, and we watched. He had great legs. We stood up and we watched him go. We watched him out of sight. And my mother said, "Where do you reckon he's going, running like that?" We had never seen a jogger. And, of course, he was one of those vistas that we had heard about who had come in.
Yeah, see, I think that's an interesting part of that. The fact that a vista worker was in your community tells us something about the fact that there was a good deal of poverty around
you. Oh, yeah, this was the war on poverty.
You also say this. He was going back to where he came from eventually, but most of us weren't going anywhere.
That's right.
Except you were raised to leave.
Well, I didn't know it at the time, but that's what somebody, a very smart old man, told me later, he said, well, hell, honey, you was always raised to leave. And in a way, that's true, because my mother had come from elsewhere. My daddy's family had been there for eight generations, just mountain clan through and through. But my mother had aspirations, and she wanted me to go to college, and she wanted me not to run off and get married to my boyfriend and all this kind of stuff. She wanted me to go to college, and she wanted me to be a lady. And all of this seemed to involve leaving, you know, getting out of there. I always say out, like people would say, when did you get in? When are you going out? You know, it was like being in a bowl in a way.
Starting at about the time you were 8 years old, you, as you said, you were hearing stories all
around you. Oh, my
gosh.
Yeah, I'll tell you, my my family were not particularly big readers, but they were incredible storytellers. All of them.
Who's the best storyteller in the family?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. Probably my Uncle Vern, maybe my Uncle Cart, maybe my daddy. But I cannot even tell you how many nights I fell asleep in somebody's lap on somebody's porch just trying desperately to stay awake long enough to hear the end of the story being told. So that even today, you know, a million years later, stories still come to me in a human voice. And it's usually the voice of somebody who loved me, you know, but in a human voice. And so often it's the voice of the main character in the story or another important character in the story. But sometimes it just seems to be the voice of the story itself. And all I have to do is just be quiet and write it down and listen. I'm always writing longhand, so I'll be that personal kind of connection, I think. So I can't really say I'm much of a writer, in fact. I would say I'm more of a storyteller, and I just kind of transcribe from time to time.
But you point out in here that in your early years of attempting to write,
yes,
you didn't want to hear the voices of the people around you. You
no.
did not feel that that Grundy and the region in which you grew up was worthy of your attention.
No, I was always, you know, I envisioned, as you can get from that paragraph we read aloud, that a writer was somebody who wore black turtlenecks and lived in Paris and was smoking Gauloises and drinking wine and traveling and so on. And I just, as a girl, I couldn't wait to get out of there.
And you were really put off by the dialects you heard around
you.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I thought, these old stories, oh, my goodness. But I changed my tune.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a couple minutes, because you tell a wonderful story about being in college and having Eudora Welty come.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, if I could.
Sure.
I think you were about 8 years old when you decided to write a story that had a couple of fascinating characters on an incredible journey. What am I talking
about?
That's
right. That's right. Well, my whole family were Yellow Dog Democrats, you know, which means you'd vote for a yellow dog before you'd vote for a Republican. So we loved Adlai Stevenson in my house. When I was about nine, he had been much in the news, and we were so upset when he lost and so on. So Adlai Stevenson was the hero of my first little novel, which was written on my mother's crane stationery. And in the novel, Adlai Stevenson falls in love with Jane Russell, who was the star of many Westerns that appeared. The movies only changed about every 10 days, and she had been in many movies that I'd seen. So in this novel, Jane Russell and Adlai Stevenson fall in love, and they go west in a covered wagon. And once they get there, they get married and then become Mormons. And I don't know why. I think some Mormons had come to our door. And, you know, anytime anybody came to your door, it was a big deal because strangers never came and so on. So that was my first novel. And looking back, you know, I'm still kind of writing about love and flight and, you know, adventure like that. Those are some old themes for me.
If I can, I'm fascinated. There are a couple of essays in here where you talk about the culture of the South in such a vivid way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And one of the ways in which you talk about it is the music. You say that your One of the don'ts was you were not supposed to be listening to the music of what the
music that surrounded us. Again, because my mother said, well, now don't listen to all that old hillbilly music. But of course, I loved it. And so did my daddy. And so did everybody else. And it really did surround us from the string band playing out on the sidewalk in front of my father's dime store to my best friend's father, who was always playing his guitar down on the riverbank for us, you know, after supper. Two, and this is one of my favorite memories, Ralph Stanley, the Stanley brothers, would come every Saturday night, and they would play. They would climb up on top of the concession stand at the drive-in. We said the drive-in theater. So they would climb up on top of the concession stand and play music. And we would all bring supper, you know, and sit out on a quilt, and people would be clogging on the concrete thing where you got your Coca-Colas. And, you know, it was just wonderful. And that's one of my favorite memories is the Stanley Brothers singing while it got dark and the lightning bug started coming out. And then they get down and everybody go get their cars and the movie would start. And in my mind, it's always Thunder Road.
What were the songs the Stanley Brothers were singing in those days?
Well, they were singing pretty much what they continued to sing, which were the old mountain, you know, was the old mountain music.
And of course, we get to know Ralph. Most of us were introduced to Ralph Stanley if we weren't listening to the records earlier on in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Absolutely. And see, to me, this whole thing, the Ralph Stanley story, symbolizes the whole way I've come to really appreciate my Appalachian culture and prize it and write about it. And years and years later, for a significant anniversary, I can't remember what one it was, my husband surprised me by buying tickets to Carnegie Hall when Ralph Stanley and the whole cast of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou gave the Down from the Mountain concert. And there I was in my $100 seat at the end of that concert, standing up on top of the seat, just screaming and crying as Ralph closed down the concert by singing that amazing a cappella song, Oh Death.
Oh, death. Oh, death. Won't you spare me over till another year? Well, what is this that I can't see with ice cold hands taking hold of me?
It goes on for like 4 or 5 minutes. You could have heard a pin drop in Carnegie Hall. And then everybody just went crazy. It was one of the most moving things that's ever happened. And that was full circle for me.
Yeah.
Symbolizing everything. There is a part of me that loved sitting on my quilt when I was a child and hearing that music, you know, just out in the night, you know, at home. But I also loved being there with all those New Yorkers, you know, and people loving it. Everybody loving it. I think that's what we want.
So music, you talk about music.
It's been really important to me, and it's been really important in my work. I think, as I say, because I'm a listener, you know, more than a writer. And so I think the songs keep coming back all throughout my writing. And in fact, I wrote one whole novel named The Devil's Dream, which tells the whole history of country music through one made-up singing family based upon the Carter family. And we used to go over to the Carter Fold, you know, to A.P. Carter's store on Saturday nights and hear them.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's not far. It's just right, it's over in Abingdon. You know, it was not far at all. And we'd go over there and listen to them all the time and dance and, you know.
For those people who aren't steeped in kind of the real traditional country.
Yeah.
The Carter family was the royal family of country
Absolutely.
Music in those days.
Absolutely.
Mother Maybelle Carter was royalty.
That's right. That's right. And recorded in the Bristol Sessions, you know, which was the official commercial beginning of country music.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, more with Lee Smith.
I have heard of a the beautiful home of the soul. Built by Jesus on high, there we never shall die, is a land where we'll never grow old. Never grow old,
where we'll never grow old,
in a land where we'll never grow old. Never grow old.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to best-selling author Lee Smith about her memoir, Dime Store. It's filled with stories about growing up and eventually leaving her beloved Appalachian mountain town of Grundy, Virginia. We recorded our conversation with Smith this past May. The other thing that you write about so eloquently in here is food, especially your mother's recipe box. You say... Do you want to read a little of this? Would you be comfortable with reading just the first part of it there?
Absolutely. And I this is the kind of thing that interests me so much, too, because I think that things tell us a story, you know, artifacts, stuff tells us a story. And I was one of the founding fellows at Duke's Institute for Documentary Studies, and I've always been particularly interested in the stories we find in things, such as when my mother died. Her recipe box, which told the whole story of her life. So I'll start reading here. My mother's recipe box sits on the windowsill in our North Carolina kitchen, where my eye falls on it 20, maybe 30 times a day. I will never move it. An anachronism in my own modern kitchen, the battered box contains my mother's whole life story in a way, with all its places and phases, all her hopes, and the accommodation she made in the name of love, as I have done, as we all do. I can read it like a novel, for in fact, our recipes tell us everything about us, where we live, what we value, how we spend our time. Mama's recipe box is an odd green gold in color. She antiqued it, then decoupaged it, with domestic decals of the 50s, one depicts a rolling pin, a flower sifter, a vase of daisies, and a cheerful, curly-headed mom wearing a red bead necklace. Another shows a skillet, a milk bottle, a syrup pitcher, three eggs, and a grinning dad in an apron.
That's such a lovely passage.
Thank you.
I can read it like a novel.
You can. You really can. You really can.
And you talk in that section of the book about things like you start talking about food, the foods that your mother cooked.
Yeah, because in her recipe box, the first recipes are all from her childhood on Chincoteague Island, all the way across the whole state of Virginia, where her father had died when she was only three, living a family with no means of support, six children. So my grandmother turned the whole place into a boarding house, and my mama had to help cook in the kitchen, help the cook, Osi. And that's where she might learn to make her famous cornmeal fritters. But from that period of her life, the recipe box had 16 different recipes for oysters and clams, planked shad, cooter pie, every kind of thing you can imagine from Chincoteague. So that was her childhood. Those were those recipes.
But then she has Bridge Club recipes, the ladies who came to
ladies.
Bridge.
Oh, yes, and Mama's Bridge Club recipes. they all play bridge on Thursdays, you know, for years until they all begin to either die or move to Florida, you know. And this was my very idea of elegance. And later on, I realized, it's so funny, all the Bridge Club recipes required mushroom soup, Jell-O, Dream Whip or pecans, but they were so elegant. Everything was pink and light green and my very idea of elegance. And I think I knew, even then, I was up at the top of the staircase, you know, looking down, watching them and nibbling on their wonderful food myself. And I think I knew that the way those ladies were was somehow a way that I would never be. But I just treasured it, even at the time. Loved it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as long as we're talking about those ladies, There's an interesting story in the book. At a certain point, you're kind of told, well, you should write what you know. And the first thing that occurs to you is, well, all I know are these women sitting around talking about whether one of them should have a hysterectomy or not. Why would I write about that?
Those were my mother and my aunt sitting on the porch when I was waiting for my daddy to pick me up and take me to college. And I thought, I cannot wait to get out of here.
But, and this is where we pick up the writing story again. You're in college. And a writer is coming to school to give a talk.
That's right. And I should say I'm in college, and I'm in the creative writing class.
Yeah.
But so far I've made only C+, because the stories I kept writing were set in faraway places. My characters would be, say, a stewardess in Hawaii when I had never practically ever been on a plane and certainly not been to Hawaii. And they kept telling me, write what you know. But the problem with that was, at that point, I didn't know what I knew until Mr. Rubin, our teacher, Lewis Rubin, invited this lady I'd never heard of named Miss Eudora Welty to class. We were freshmen. And all of a sudden, the whole back of the class just filled up with other faculty, with bearded graduate students from UVA and stuff like that. And we began to realize that something special was going to happen. But then when she came in, she just looked like all my aunts.
Well, you didn't even want to go. You were planning on skipping class.
I was going to go up and drink some beer at Carvin's Cove and act like a writer and stomp around looking moody with my guitar. So, you know.
And what happened when
you walked
in and the first thing you notice is, who is this? She doesn't look like a writer.
Right. She just looked like every sweet little Southern lady you'd ever seen, with this little voile dress that buttoned up the front, and she had the sweetest smile and big blue eyes. And she started reading in this, she's from Mississippi, but her voice was lovely. It was a lilting, tripping, kind of fast little Southern voice, just sort of like this. And she read that story, A Worn Path, which is one of the best stories ever written in the world. And it's about Miss Phoenix Jackson, who's going to get the medicine for her little grandson who will die without it. And it's a mythic journey through various sort of talismanic people that come and, you know, encounter her along the way, and she gets the medicine to save her little grandson. And at the end of it, she finished and she just smiled this beautiful tremulous smile and looked all around and she said, well, any questions? And so hands are waving all over the room, and right in the very back there's this one bearded guy. And I can tell, I mean, from what I know now, I know that his dissertation was riding on this. And he's waving his hand. He's, Miss Welty, I can't imagine, how did you come up with the perfect symbol, the marble cake? Because somebody gives Miss Phoenix Jackson a piece of marble cake. He said, it is the perfect union, the perfect symbol of the male and female principle joined together, of the eternal and the temporal, of yin and yang. And then he's making these little yin-yang shapes with his hand. And we're all just kind of looking at him. And it's a very 60s conversation. And then Miss Welty says, well, she says, it's a recipe that's been in my family for years. And I was just struck dead, because my mother made the best marble cake in town. And I just thought, wait a minute. You know, this is the most beautiful story. This is real literature. And the stuff of it is maybe the stuff of my life, of simple, you know, simple people and the things that I know growing up, and the kind of people I knew growing up. Small town, and, you know, and I began to change my tune radically.
Eudora Welty wrote in a book about her, about writing, the process.
Beautiful book.
Yeah. My imagination takes its strength and guides its direction from what I see and hear and learn and feel and remember of my living world. And that quote matters so much to you that you put it
in Dime Store.
It does.
I put it right in there. Yeah. Because I think for a long time you can't maybe see your own living world. And you don't, you know, you're so busy when you're young trying to get out of it maybe. But then once you can see it, of course, you know more about it than anyone else in the world.
Given this new understanding, Lee Smith, what happens to the story of your mother and aunts sitting on the porch talking about a hysterectomy, which you thought was probably the most mundane thing in the world?
Oh, my God. Well,
I had one story left to write in that semester in which Miss Welty had come to visit. And guess what? I wrote a story about three women sitting on a porch, whether one of them does or does not need a hysterectomy. And guess what? I got an A. And I really learned something in that whole process.
And so this really does launch you on the career that has made you such a celebrated author, writing about the things you have always known.
Yeah, and there's always more to learn.
Yeah.
Too. And so in many of these things I have always known, I have delved into, I guess, even further. Because, you know, most of us can't just go out there and experience everything ourselves all the time. But, you know, I have used the tools of oral history and real history and so on to write about my region, going back into time, going into certain, you know, particular pockets like country music or serpent handling or whatever it might, 18th century teachers, whatever it might happen to be. And it's just been a great pleasure to do this work.
You ask a really wonderful question that is relevant to everybody in our listening audience, especially those folks up in North Georgia. You say, what is it about Appalachia that so captures the mind, echoes in the ear, and lodges in the heart? That's a wonderful question. What's the answer?
Well, I think one answer for sure was given to me by an old lady who just said, she said, you know, I just think there's more there. And I think that's true. I think in certain ways, its isolation has provided the chance to go deep, you know, and a real richness of folklore, a particularity of music, a kind of knowing all your family, knowing who you are, knowing where you come from. And it's a very, very rich vein. We have an awful lot of really good Appalachian writers, too, both older and current.
Yeah, you do talk about it. You love Charles Frazier, Cold Mountain, Barbara Kingsolver,
right?
Prodigal Summer, Flight Behavior, which was just
isn't that amazing?
Her last novel and
just
a wonderful book.
I know.
Who are
and
the others?
And also, Ron Rash would be huge, I think. But there are many, and there are younger ones all the time coming. And I think there's so many issues right now, too, such as mountaintop removal mining and drugs and, you know, ecological disasters and just all the changes that are happening in towns such as my own town, Grundy, where, you know, the main anything where there was a single industry, and that was coal, and it's gone. And what's happening? I mean, Grundy lost, since 1980, has lost 40% of its population. Mm. Buchanan County has, and so on. So, you know, an area of change, that's where the stories are happening. Because to have a story, you have to have conflict. And we have always had it in Appalachia. And we have writers that are going right to the heart of it.
And some of the writers who you have encountered, who you think are extraordinary writers, aren't necessarily even publishing their work. One of the people in your book who is so moving is Lou Crabtree. Who is Lou Crabtree?
Lou Crabtree was a woman who showed up in my life when she was already kind of an old woman in a free class I was teaching up in Abingdon in the attic of a church, actually. And she just showed up there. The class was already in progress, sitting around a round table. And I had told them each to bring a story and to be prepared to read the first line of the story. And then all of a sudden, here came Lou, up the staircase, just a huge commotion, you know,
so
all
by herself.
She's
wearing a man's hat, fuzzy
bedroom
slippers.
She always wore a man's hat. She wore those fuzzy pink bedroom slippers. And she was dropping pencils and everything and just laughing and singing and coming up the steps. And she sat down and she said, well, I'm Lou Crabtree, and I just love to write. And boy, did my heart sink. Because I thought, okay, she's going to disturb this whole class. Here is the old eccentric person that you'd just rather die than have in a class. And so I said, well, Lou, we all read in the first line of our stories out loud, and we go around. And so she said, all right. And so people went around, and they read the first lines. They were mostly teachers of one kind or another, people. And we got to Lou, and her first line was this. Old Reller had 13 miscarriages, and she named every one of them. Which still makes the hair on my arms just stand right up. And I said, well, go on. And she did. And she read the whole story. And I had never heard anything like it. It was just incredible. And I said, well, Lou, have you got any more stories? And she said, mm-hmm. And I said, well, bring me a few more tomorrow. She brought a suitcase. She brought a suitcase, this battered suitcase of stories and poems written on every kind of paper, shirt backs, I mean, little scraps of paper, church programs, all kinds of things. And she'd been writing her whole life. And it was the first time I understood that writing could be something to give you strength, just to, you know, when you have a hard life, when you're in hard times, that just writing about it could give you strength and, you know, make it through the night, get you through the night.
And
she
told
was
you
the
that.
Very, yeah, yeah.
She said, I get up and write in the middle of the night. That's
yeah.
how I soothe
Absolutely.
My
Absolutely. Yeah. And I could see the whole record of her life in that suitcase, you know. And for instance, there was one very bitter poem named Sweet Holler Number One. And it was about her life when she'd had like 5 children in 7 years out on a mountain farm and boiling out their diapers and clothes, you know, in this big, I mean, it was hard, hard times, and it was very bitter. And then there was a later poem that she wrote after all those children had survived and had grown up, and she was looking back on those days that had been hard days. And it was named Sweet Holler Number Two, feeling bad about writing Sweet Holler Number One. Simone de Beauvoir said, I do not want to lead an unexamined life. Yeah. And Lou didn't either. And I don't either.
Well,
and so, you know, so a lot of this book is really about writing and how it can help us make it through the night.
Well, and that's where you and Lou have something very important in common.
I learned it from Lou.
You learned that writing can help you get through those hard nights. But you certainly shared this compulsion you both had to write. You have had to write,
absolutely,
as we hear throughout Dime
Absolutely.
Store, your entire life.
That's true. And I asked Lou one time, I said, Lou, well, what would you do if somebody told you you couldn't write anymore? And she said, well, I reckon I'd just hide and do it. She said, I'd sneak and do it. And, you know, I'm the same.
We haven't talked about why you've decided to call your book of essays about your life Dime Store. It's really not just a tribute to your father, but it's an evocation of your earliest memories.
It is an evocation of my earliest memories. And in a way, this is a book about a time gone by, you know, and a kind of life that we don't have, kind of store that we don't have anymore. You know, the family-owned Dime Store. One of many family-owned stores on Main Street, America. And I think this is just kind of a celebration. It's a sort of a love song of those days and that kind of town and that kind of store and that kind of businessman, you know. My daddy, you know, he was a great businessman, but on Christmas Eve, if people couldn't pay for their layaways, he'd just give them out, you know.
And you spent many a day in that store.
I did. My first job, I mean, I went to work with Daddy when I was like 5 years old. And my job, of course, at first was taking care of the dolls.
Brushing their hair, straightening their dresses.
Straightening their dresses. And I gave every one of them a name. Well, 3 names. Each one of them had 3 names. And there would be like Mary Elizabeth Satterfield, for instance, for a very dressed up kind of lady doll, or Baby Betsy Black, you know, for a little baby doll, and so on. And I made up huge stories about their lives before they got to the Dime Store. And I'd say, now she's from Alaska or whatever, you know, their lives before they got to the Dime Store, and then their lives after they left my care. And another thing about the Dime Store, I think it's very important to me as a writer, the time I spent there, because Daddy had this office that was kind of suspended over the whole floor of the dime store. And so, and I had my own little typewriter up there, spent so much time in that office counting money and typing and doing whatever Daddy or Roberta told me to do, and looking out at the whole floor of the dime store, and I could see everybody. I mean, everybody. And I saw, you know, not only shoplifting, which I saw from time to time, but people slap their children and kiss each other and embraces and fights. I mean, I saw everything. And later I would realize, you know, this was the perfect, and I would make up stories about all the things that were happening, why they were doing these things, what they were fighting about. And it was really the perfect education for a fiction writer. And I was, of course, the omniscient narrator, which is a privileged position for a little girl to have.
But it wasn't all idyllic when you were growing up. Your parents were both had both serious issues in terms of mental health. Your father now would be diagnosed probably as bipolar.
Yeah, he would be diagnosed
now
as bipolar.
What did he call it, though? Nervous? What
was it? He would just say, well, you know, I've always been kindly nervous.
Kindly nervous.
And to the point where he would, at times, become totally immobile. Immobilized. And then at that point, that was where the wonderful big family came in. My Uncle Cart, my cousin Jack, or some, you know, others would come and help get him off to a hospital. And my mother also suffered from anxiety and depression.
As you've grown older,
yeah,
do you breathe a sigh of relief that having had two parents with significant emotional and mental issues, that you... that you've come through this okay, that you haven't struggled with what they did?
Well, actually, one of Mama's psychiatrists was instrumental. Because, you know, the thing is, mental illness in a family affects everyone. It affects the children. It affects the siblings. It affects everyone. And in those days, you were not supposed to talk about it. Big stigma, you know. And my mother really believed that if you don't mention something, it doesn't exist. You know, this is the thing. And, of course, there has been and is to this day a stigma about mental illness, which is one reason I wanted to get it out there and write about it, right? Because so much can be done. But anyway, I was supposed to not talk about it. And I was living with my Aunt Millie. Daddy was in a mental hospital in Connecticut, and Mama was at UVA, Charlottesville. And I was going down on the train. I was 13. I was going down on the train to visit Mama. So anyway, we got this call from Mama's doctor, who was a famous physician, actually. Later, I would learn, Dr. Ian Stevenson. And he asked if he could take me to lunch when I came down to visit my mother. Well, this kind of thing would never happen today, you know. But anyway, so I go on the train. I get down. I'm met by this tall, balding gentleman with sort of jug ears, who is carrying a rose. And he took me to a very fancy restaurant for lunch. And we got, I ordered a club sandwich because he did. And it was like in four triangles with little flags on each one. It was very exciting. And we talked about poetry. And I recited Annabel Lee to him. He was so sweet. And then at a certain point, he leaned forward and he said, I wonder if you ever have anything that you worry about. And I just was amazed. And I said, oh, no. And he said, well, I think a lot of little girls in your situation might worry whether they're going to go crazy, too. Do you ever worry about this? And I couldn't believe it because, of course, I thought about it all the time. And I said, yes. And he leaned back and he gave me this big grin. And he said, well, I'm an excellent doctor. And I can tell you that you are just fine. You're going to be just fine. I think you should read a lot more poems and write some more stories, and you will grow up and you will be just fine. And whether I would or not, it was just so great.
What a wonderful
for him to
gesture.
Say that, because of course I've thought about it. You know, you do worry about that as a child, and you can't say it to anybody. So that was wonderful.
Well, I don't mean to go from a difficult subject, mental health, to perhaps an even more difficult one, but I would like to talk to you about one more issue. Fair and Tender Ladies, which I think most people would say is the book that really put you on the map with
the
biggest
number. Thank you. Well, it really is a book where you know, it's very hard when you think of your work to ever sort of separate what you were going through at the time you were writing a book from what the book is about, which was just going to be about, you know, one woman's hard but I felt heroic life, an Appalachian woman like so many of the women that I had known growing up. But then, once I began writing it, my mother went into her final illness, and suddenly I was getting a divorce, and suddenly my son Josh had been diagnosed at 17 with schizophrenia, and he was in his first major break, you know, and so he was in a hospital, mama's in a hospital, and suddenly the writing of that book took on just an incredible intensity, and I was teaching, I had to teach. And it took on this incredible intensity. And the main character of it, the narrator, Ivy Rowe, just got stronger and stronger and stronger the more I fell apart. She was the friend I needed, you know, to see me through. You know, she, no matter what happened to her, she had the guts to go through it. And so I guess I did too. So and it was my first real example of what Lou had said, you know, that writing can really help you get through the hard times.
So that book was published in, I think, 1988, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we were all younger back in 1988.
Oh, yeah.
But here's what I was thinking about when I was getting ready to talk to you. There's a point in the book in which Ivy, if you don't mind, I'm going to read you your
please
words.
No, please do. Please do.
Ivy said at one point, "It's like I was a girl for such a long time. Years and years, and then all of a sudden, I've got to be an old woman with no in-between. Maybe that has always been the problem with me, a lack of in-between. For all of a sudden, I said to myself, Ivy, this is your life. This is your real life, and you are living it. Your life is not going to start later. This is it. It is now. But now I'm so tired, just plain tired, tired unto death, it seems." And I won't go on, but it's a beautiful passage. And one of the reasons I read it to you is, do you ever feel as you look at your life now that it's hard to imagine the in-between because it all passes so quickly?
Absolutely. And what you just, you know, what you just, when I wrote that, I was a lot younger. But it seems absolutely true to me now, more so.
It's a beautiful
passage. Because I was thinking about, you know, being an older woman.
How does that feel to you? I'm struggling right now with understanding
it's
that
hard.
I've reached an age where
my
days
so fast.
Are numbered.
It goes so fast.
Yeah.
You know. And, and I'm so glad that, you know, I don't always remember really well who I was and what I was thinking at any particular time in my life. But I can go back and read what I wrote, and I will know who I was then and how I felt.
Lee Smith, thank you so much for being here. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it was a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about Lee Smith's memoir, Dime Store, and more about her other work, check out the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. After a break, David Sibley, one of the world's leading authorities on birds, talks about the beauty of birdsong. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. As I mentioned at the start of the show, we thought that after a long and toxic presidential race, it would be a good idea for us to offer something to soothe frayed nerves, to help us all take a deep breath and relax. What better way to do that than to go back and listen again to the conversation we had last spring with David Allen Sibley, Sibley's one of the world's greatest authorities on birds. We talked with him just as the second edition of his Guide to the Birds of North America was published last spring.
Some of the most common backyard birds in this area would be the cardinal. And they're probably birds that almost anyone could see in their yard or in a park nearby. Robin, blue jay, Carolina wren is very common but rarely seen, more often heard. They have a loud chanting song that you'll hear all over, but very difficult to see. Common grackle and mourning dove.
Jenny Amond, our producer, and I looked at a list that we thought was interesting because, to some extent at least, the sound that the bird makes is a part of its name.
Mm.
Okay? So, for instance, you mentioned the mourning dove.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound mournful.
It does. Yeah. But they're not.
They're not. Tell me about the mourning dove.
It's a very common bird. It has adapted really well to suburban kinds of habitats. So it's common all across the U.S.
What is a laughing gull?
Laughing gull is, it's the gull, it's the classic beach gull.
It took a while there, but I heard that bird laughing.
Yes. Yeah, obviously named for their call.
The song sparrow is, I think, a relatively common bird everywhere, isn't it?
They only nest in northern Georgia. They're found all across Georgia in the winter, but I believe they're only found in the northern parts of the state in the summer.
That's a song that I know I hear a lot in my neighborhood, for instance. What are some of the bird songs that just move you the most deeply?
My favorite bird song, the one that really makes me stop and just listen and enjoy it for whenever I hear it, is Hermit Thrush, which is, the thrushes all have fantastic songs. Hermit Thrush, to me, is just one of the most evocative, wonderful sounds, and they're also often in really almost spiritual sort of places, a deep forest, a hemlock grove, among redwoods in a canyon in California. These are some of the places where I have remember hearing them. So it's often deep in the forest in a, it seems like a really special place to begin with, and then this haunting sound that comes out of the trees. I'm not a sort of classically religious person, but my own version of religion is nature. I feel like I'm part of something bigger, seeing birds, and I see a migrating bird that has just come back from South America or maybe has come down from its nesting grounds in the Arctic. And just looking at it and knowing that, I sort of zoom out and see myself as one little dot on the globe with birds passing by in all directions. And it's a really... a very nice feeling to be sort of, to feel like a part of something bigger and also connected at the same time.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Well, David Allen Sibley, I think it's fairly clear from the way we talk that I am not personally a birder. But reading through your guides, talking to you about bird song, listening to bird song with you, has really, in just a very short time, given me kind of a new appreciation for these remarkable animals that are around me all day, every day. And until I sit and talk to you, I've never thought a great deal about. So thank you for that gift and for being here today.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
David Allen Sibley is the writer and illustrator of Birds West and Birds East, comprehensive regional guides to the birds of North America.
Oh, well, everybody's heard about the bird.
That's it for us for today. Our senior producer is the immensely talented Jenny Ament. Jenny also edited the wonderful segment on birdsong. Our intern is James Rising. I'm Bill Nigut. Hope to see you again here next week for another Two-Way Street.
Everybody knows that the bird is a winner, winner, bird, bird, the bird, the winner, winner.